I'm John DiLiberto, and you're hearing the Echoes podcast from PRX. A few months ago, I interviewed the British synth-pop group Ladytron. That feature was a fun one to put together, intercutting their interview with their music. But the interview itself was much longer than we used on air and in the podcast. Today, I've got the complete interview, and it is fascinating hearing about this band, inspired by 1980s electronica, buying old synthesizers at boot sales, and creating their sound. I talked to two-thirds of the trio, Helen Marnie, who was in England, and Daniel Hunt, who was in Brazil. They said their latest album, Time's Arrow, was a reaction to pandemic music.
We actually made a conscious decision to try and insulate the material of the album from the pandemic, because we thought no one's going to want to think about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I want people to dance. Like, I want, like, happiness. I want hope. I don't want this inward kind of, like, sadness.
That's Daniel Hunt and Helen Marnie, two-thirds of Ladytron. I talked to them today in the Echoes podcast. Have you been wanting to represent by rocking out in Echoes gear? Well, not only do we have the t-shirt, but lots of other items that have the Echoes logo, so you can show the world where the chill resides. There's sweatshirts, hoodies, insulated mugs, and more. Go to echoes.org, click on store, select the new products tab. There's all kinds of cool stuff there, including a Christmas ornament. Go to echoes.org, hit store, then new products. And now, get ready for a journey into electronica with Ladytron's Helen Marnie and Daniel Hunt.
I'm Daniel Hunt, and I'm writer, producer, keyboard player, guitarist in Ladytron.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you a question about the band name while we're still waiting for Helen, because you had that name before she was in the group, right?
Yeah, it was kind of an idea for a band, and it was this very kind of loose concept. Like, I told some people about it, like, I think Bob Stanley from Saint Etienne actually was one of the first people I talked to about this idea. You know, it was very naive and trial by error at the time. And I worked with a few singers. And then as soon as we met Helen and Mira, then it became a band. It became bigger than this loose concept. That was the part that became real. So prior to that, some of the recordings, some of the first album, for example, you know, belongs to that earlier iteration. But it was midway through that recording of the first album that it really came. It's like, hold on, we're a group now and a gang, you know?
So two things about that name. First, I know the reference.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you know the reference? Because that album came out before you were born.
yeah, I suppose I got into Roxy Music probably in the early 90s. I was obviously aware of them when I was growing up, and Brian Ferry's solo. They weren't a band I was into when I was a kid. So I got into them via, I guess, my interest in synths and keyboards, and I was just looking for a different route through the past than the well-trodden one that existed at that time. So I'm talking about, you know, maybe 1991. Liverpool is an amazing place to grow up around music, because everyone had the best records. You know, you were instructed. Incredible records that are now quite commonplace. I mean, I use the example of the United States of America album. So I had that record when I was 18 years old. Because everybody had it in Liverpool. Liverpool was a very distorted music city, which dated back to the Eric's scene. All those bands, Big in Japan, Bunny Men, Tiddler Explodes, everything else. And so when I started going out, it was the same people, you know, on the scene still. It seemed like a completely different epoch, but it was only 10 years prior. So I describe it as a head start in those days. So Roxy Music were obviously a group that all those people had been into in the 70s. I think that the influence of Roxy on punk and new wave was kind of lost a little bit in the 80s. It felt like people were not joining the dots anymore, in a way. And I just felt like that first Roxy album, the first two Roxy albums, I just felt there was this different path available without sounding like them or anything like that. It was just in its philosophy and its attitude, obviously sonically in some ways. So I got into it maybe when I was 18 or so. I was obsessed with Roxy then. And that's when I started organizing parties in Liverpool. And so like Remake Remodel, I'd play that out every week. Yeah, that's how it came to be. But then again, I just thought it was a great name for a band. I just thought, wouldn't it be amazing? Why isn't there a band called this already?
Did people think that it was going to be a band of female musicians?
Sometimes they do. Yeah, they do. I remember early on, there was like a little, we got like a press snippet through from somewhere in the States and described us as four cool chicks with cool jobs or something like that. So, yeah. But then again, I think in a way it's opened some doors to us because everyone loves Roxy Music. And so the way we came to be signed originally was because Steve Pross, who signed us to Emperor Norton Records in California at the beginning, he picked up an EP in Japan that we'd done, which was kind of like the more or less half of the first album or a third of the first album. And he thought we were a Japanese band, firstly. And he also, it was like, oh my God, there's a band called Ladytron. I might have to check this out. So it did open some doors for us. And then ultimately we ended up playing at Brian Eno's festival at the Sydney Opera House. And I guess we came on his radar because of that, because of our name, I think via his daughter.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So United States of America, that's a really obscure reference for you to pull out. That's like a 68 album.
Yeah, and it was, as I say, a group of records that had an amplified, a magnified relevance in Liverpool somehow. A more obvious one is Love and Forever Changes. Everyone had that record. It's a record that everyone has now. Everyone has the album now. But back then, it was rather obscure in Britain. The United States of America album was hugely influential on me. A few groups came along and they were very into that record as well, like Broadcast, for example. I mean, they sounded a lot like the record, the USA itself, but so a lot of the music I was into in the 90s actually were influenced by that. Stereolab as well.
United States of America, we had them on the show.
Oh,
Joseph
kidding.
Bird and the singer, Dorothy Filarski, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, I think that actually, because I liked Stereolab, the early Stereolab stuff, I think someone recommended the USA album to me for that reason when I was about 18. Yeah. But I see it mentioned a hell of a lot now. It's, you know, it's a record that took a long time, break.
yeah. Their one and only album.
Yeah, because there was a second. There was the Joseph Bird and
Joseph
the Field
Bird
Hippies.
And the Field Hippies, which is...
Yeah. It's okay. It's got its moments, yeah.
Yeah.
But that first record, Love Song for the Dead Shay, incredible. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's amazing the stuff they were doing. You consider no synthesizer keyboards or anything like that.
It was homemade, totally homemade. Boxes, yeah.
Yeah, processed violin, no guitar even, processed violin, you know.
Oh, I remember actually being fascinated by that it was no guitar. It was just bass, drums, violin, and vocal, really, isn't it? And whatever electronic machine. Yeah. You know,
exactly. But all the instruments had some electronic component. Hey, Helen.
Hello.
It seems like you guys got into analog synths when they were very much out of style. Is that how you kind of started?
Yeah, I guess following on from what we were talking about, Stereolab and United States of America and things like that. So long before the band met, I'd started buying analog synths very, very cheaply. And it was before they were very fetishized. it was more just what was available. Like you'd be in a charity shop and there would be a Korg MS-20 there or something, and you could pick it up for £15. And people, there wasn't this insane value on everything. And so there was a kind of geeky quality to collecting this stuff, but it wasn't like, I think nowadays it's all about the gear fetish and people spending just ridiculous amounts of money on stuff they don't really need. And to be honest, I mean, even though I'm, you know, kind of analog zealot, if I was given advice to somebody starting out now, I would say, don't bother buying anything. Just make music with the cheapest possible equipment you can get. And if that means just a laptop and nothing else, just do it. You know, you're not obligated to spend tens of thousands of pounds on gear. But we started that way. And, you know, it's so we still get a lot of, you know, sort of train spotter type interests in what we're playing. I think, to be honest, I was thinking about it the other day, I think that we should actually publish some kind of list of every keyboard we've ever used, because it is quite interesting to people who are into that stuff. But yeah, that's how it began.
Do you vibe on that, Helen?
the synth nerds would really appreciate that list, I think. Yeah. Yeah, we were all really poor as well. We were so poor then, you know. I was just out of university and like, I wasn't earning anything. Danny wasn't earning anything. We were all like, well, you DJed, so I guess you got money from that. But yeah.
And spent it on keyboards.
Yeah, and I didn't actually collect keyboards before I met Danny, and then I started to collect keyboards, for better or worse. But yeah, I mean, I can't afford them now.
It's my fault.
I liked it when you could go to like a car boot sale, or like, you know, pick something, get a really ace, awesome keyboard out of the back of someone's car for like £100. And now, you know, you're lucky to get that keyboard for like £2,000 or something. So I liked it back in the old days. So yeah.
But you started out on classical piano, right?
Yeah, I studied piano from about the age of 8. I've really let it slide. I can barely play two hands together now, but I blame Ladytron for that, because I don't use two hands that very often. But yeah.
You're playing mono synth.
Yeah, that as well, yeah. Yes, I did. I played classical, and that's, yeah, a long, long time ago. But
well, what flipped the switch for you to start playing electronic keyboards?
I played like keyboards and stuff before, obviously. It's just that I had a piano growing up, so that was what was natural to me, and that's what I wanted to study. I was pretty intense about it for a while, I guess. I used to, you know, come home from school or whatever, and then have to do 1 to 2 hours a night to practice to get, you know, for my exams and everything that I needed. I guess at university, listening to different music and like just even contemporary stuff that was around at the time, like maybe Air and things like that, made me start to think about electronic music. But also, you know, I always wanted to be a singer or front a band or something. And so then I met this guy, Danny, and yeah, the rest is history. That's what happened. So it just became natural, second nature to use keyboards instead of the piano. Although we have used piano in the studio quite often, so yeah.
Also, do you remember what song it is? But there's a track on Light and Magic where you played this classical piece you'd written, yeah, but on the Juno 6.
Yeah, there's a little
interlude. It's like an interlude.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember which song it's connected to.
No,
I was
thinking
about this the other day. It's a really nice piece.
Is it in between or is it at the end?
It's a really nice piece, because it doesn't have a track name. We've kind of forgotten about it.
Yeah.
It's funny how you forget about your own material. There's been so much of it.
Okay, so we're going to get to the new album, which is not that new anymore. When did it come out?
January.
February? January, yeah. Are you tired of talking about it?
Depends what the questions are.
Good one. Well, we'll get to it, because it's a really cool album. Okay. It's funny, because Helen, I read an interview with you where you said you thought it was one of your most energetic albums. And to my ears, it's the most chilled album you guys have done.
I'm not sure I said that, but I don't think it's the most chilled. No, I would say it's somewhere in between. There are some upbeat tracks on there, I think, but as a whole, I wouldn't say it was energetic. I don't think I said that. I think someone's just decided that I said that.
Let me see if I can
or someone
that.
Else said it. And,
you were quoted. Some differences I heard in this album, the voices are submerged in reverb more than they have ever been. And the drums are also kind of mixed down, I think, and almost muffled in a certain way compared to like your earlier music.
I think there's generally more layers, I think. And I think that's kind of gone. It was very, at the beginning, the first album particularly was very basic. And I remember when we first started going to LA and some of the people in music and production that we'd meet, that record had really caught their attention because it was so primitive and that we weren't trying to make this big Hollywood production. And so over time, we've obviously learned and we've developed, and there's definitely more layering going on. There's definitely more reverb on this one because we opened up this Danny Woodward, who mixed most of the album. He suddenly pulled out this Lexicon reverb from the 80s that he'd, I think he said he bought it from a church. And this is really quite a common thing. It's like, well, where did you get this effects processor? And it's like, it always seems to be from a church, you know, and to raise money to fix the church roof, you know, they sell these things off for, you know, really cheaply. And as soon as he plugged it in, and it was literally on the preset, the A1 or whatever, the first preset you would ever hear if you went into a music store and tried this thing out, and it was, Jesus Christ, this is incredible. And it made everything sound like Madonna. And it was instantly, and it was like, can we just put this on everything? So I told him, I was like, just take a track of the vocal on everything, on through that reverb, throw it all through and put it back into the session. And if we use it, we use it. So it became part of the character of the album by accident. So I think that's probably what people are hearing. Also, people have said things like, oh, this album has a dream pop influence, a shoegaze influence. But we've had that for 20 years. I mean, Witching Hour was, even though it was present already, Witching Hour was the first time it kind of really came to the surface and people noted it. So it was strange to see this album talked about in those terms as if this was some new development when we've been doing, it's been part of what we've been doing for 20 years.
Right.
It's funny. But, it's funny when we've been recording albums in the past and, you know, you're at the mixing stage and you're getting sent mixes. And what's happened in the past for me is I've always been, can I have more reverb, please? Can we have more reverb? Can we have it wetter? I need it wetter on my vocal. And then this time around, it was sometimes the opposite because Danny was so excited about this new reverb thing, and we would get some of the mixes back and we keep pushing it. And then sometimes we'd have to realize, we'd be like, I think we might need to pull this back just a little bit on the vocal. So, yeah, as Danny
you
says,
you don't discover that unless you try.
Exactly. And as Danny says, it's always been there. So I don't think it should be a shock to anyone when they hear this sound. I think we've been doing it for quite a while. Yeah.
I was just going to say, just as an aside, that I think the balance of the components that make our sound shift back and forth over time. And so certain albums, certain elements will come to the fore more than on others. So I see it more like that, rather than some kind of linear progression.
Well, when you're tracking, Helen, what kind of reverb are you hearing then?
I don't know. What reverb? It's just
something basic you would just throw on.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh. I'm just wondering how it affects your singing to have that reverb going on.
We came on post.
Yeah, post.
I know the reverb on the album is post.
I mean, oh, right, okay.
But you're...
So when I'm singing, when I'm tracking, I wouldn't generally have reverb. Depends on the vibe of the song. So sometimes it is required ever so slightly. But yeah, ever so slightly. Otherwise, you wouldn't really know where you were. You'd be all over the place. I'd be like... be swirling around in my own head. So, yeah, no, tends to be very minimal or not at all. And same for when we're singing live, like at gigs and stuff. I used to not have anything in my ear, no reverb, but sometimes some songs like really warrant it, just to take you into a different like kind of atmosphere, like get you more into a vibe. So so I quite enjoy that on some tracks when I'm singing live.
So you guys have been pretty committed to this electronic sound that you've done for 20 years now, a little more. I'm wondering how you feel when other artists jump on that for just like one album. I'm thinking Madonna, Ray of Light, the Christina Aguilera album that you guys worked on, the new Taylor Swift album, Sharon
Lady
Benham.
Gaga.
You know, they jump on, they do one album, then they're back to whatever their usual stuff was.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, fair play to them. If they're influenced by us, that's great. But also, I mean, it does irk me a little bit when they make a lot of money, like a hell of a lot of money.
So do you sit there saying, we've been doing this for like, you know, 20 years, man.
We're too legit to quit. No, it's also strange because things come and go. As you say, people get on, they'll get on the train for one record but it happens so quickly. And I go, oh yeah, so-and-so was doing something along these lines. And then you look, when was that? And it was already 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it changes so fast and they've already gone on to something else. They might have come back to it again now. I'm not really following these things. So occasionally someone says, have you heard this? And sometimes people interpret records differently. If they're not involved in music or music production, they might hear something that's reminiscent and they might assume, they'll go, oh, have you heard this? This is a complete ripoff of Ladytron or whatever. And occasionally that'll like land with me. But sometimes I can hear it. Other times they've picked up on a detail that isn't really a direct influence. There have been straight up copies in the past, but that's fine as well. As long as people know it, as long as we get some kind of recognition for being quietly influential without ever being massive, you know, I think that's there's some honor in that.
But I think that part of the arc is that people don't always know. They don't realize where the influences come from. They don't. So that's the only problem, I think.
I think it's a kind of geeky thing again, isn't it?
It's definitely
like
a geeky
really
thing.
Into music, yeah. And if you know how music developed and you understand the chronology of it and you've really kind of studied it and grown up with it, you know how things connect together and you join the dots instinctively,
but
people come in now with everything.
Yeah, that's few people, I think, Danny. I think, Danny, that is you.
It is. No, I used to think that everyone was like that. I thought everyone will understand this. But no, the people don't even know what the chronology is of records. They would hear something from the 2000s and be surprised that there's something from the 1980s is older than it. And a lot of the chronology has been lost. Unless someone's got the time to really study what is equivalent of a university dissertation on the subject, they're not going to know, and you can't expect them to know. So I'm kind of at peace with this now. It used to work me more than it did.
Well, let's talk about your influences briefly. And again, I've read some things where you seem like you're sometimes irked by this reference, but people compare you to essentially 80s synth pop and new wave a lot of times. Now, personally, I definitely hear that reference.
Oh, it's fine. I wouldn't say I was irked by that. I think what it was at the beginning was we were coming from this place, which, as I say, was more like this lo-fi aesthetic and philosophy, Stereolab and things like that. And because of the way we looked and maybe a couple of our first early tracks, we were misinterpreted. Oh, this band are like the Human League or something like that. Obviously, I love the Human League. I always did. I think there was just a bit of a misinterpretation of what we were as a whole. But of course that influence is there. And with time, it makes a lot more sense. Even when we first started, those people were still making music. They were still around. They were the people that ran studios, that produced early demos. They were all from that new wave and post-punk scene. So there is actually a continuity in a way that, to be honest, I didn't recognize until recently. We didn't just appear out of nowhere with no connection to anything that had happened before, even though it felt a bit like that when we started.
I've got no problem with the comparisons to like the 80s. I mean, I love most of the 80s music. I grew up in the 80s.
exactly. Even
the pop music, it's all cool for me. It's when people like try and compare you to something a little bit more modern, a bit more like contemporaries. I find that harder to take, really, because half the time I just don't see it. I'm like, they'll compare me, right, or my voice or the music, just the music, to someone else that probably hasn't been doing it for as long as us, and that has maybe sprouted up in the last like 10 years or something. And I honestly can't understand it, because I still don't think that anyone sounds like us. So how can they be comparing them to us? It doesn't make sense. I've never understood it.
Yeah. And the 80s would have been your time of coming of age musically.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
90s, that would have been your time of the, you know, a lot of people just get locked into that. But
I think that there's a certain, I did another podcast recently, and it was just, I had to just list some of my favorite records, first records I heard, first records I bought, and things like that. And it made me think about that period slightly differently. That I feel like when you're in adolescence, you end up looking for your own thing, your own path. You end up looking for alternatives. Well, not everyone does, but, you know, many people do. But there's an interesting point when modernity is absolutely in sync with your understanding of popular music. And for me, this was like Pet Shop Boys' actually album. Now, at that point, it was before I'd gone off and tried to find anything different or anything weird. This was pure pop music, and I understood it, or felt I understood it completely, and it was a much simpler moment. When you're maybe 12 or 13 or something, before you go weird, before the dark clouds of adolescence descend, it's at that moment, I thought, with hindsight, that moment is super interesting, because you're completely confident in your knowledge of popular music, of popular culture. You don't see past your horizons, and you're totally comfortable with that. And I think that's a moment that we tend to forget, because everyone starts thinking that the records they were into when they were 16 were just the ultimate cultural high point. No one ever did anything better. Everyone feels like that. But I think that moment, that earlier moment, is more unexplored.
It's like you can't be cool when you're that young. Like when
you're cool anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, just because you're happy doesn't make it cool. It's like I made a dance up to like It's a Sin by the Pet Shop Boys in like my front living room. Now that's pure joy. It was like, that would be cool now. I don't know if it was cool then, but I mean, what's not to like? What's not to like about that?
The kids decide whether it's cool or not.
Yeah.
That's true.
We don't.
since we're talking about happiness, let's talk about Misery Remembers Me.
Joy, yes. Mm-hmm. What do we want to know?
Now, who wrote that track?
I wrote it with a guy that I also write with, Johnny Scott. So the two of us wrote it together, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's a song about depression.
No, I don't think so at all. No, it's really not. I would say it's about moving forward. And like, I think when we've described the album as a whole, we have said it's quite hopeful. So I still see that song as quite hopeful. It's like, it is, it's like you're moving forward, but is this something, or is this thing going to come back at you and bite you? Like, is it going to remember you? That kind of thing. It's like, you know, you really want the future to be great, but is something going to hold you back, or is that thing going to remember and, you know, ruin what you're trying to build? It's that kind of thing, but it's still hopeful. Yeah. It's definitely not about depression. No. Mm-mm.
Okay. The instrumentation on it, it starts sounding almost symphonic on that piece.
Yeah, I think that was it. We wanted it to sound really big. Like, yeah, so you can really feel the atmosphere, feel the build. It's like layers and layers, and the guitars really create that kind of washy, and the synths as well, they create that kind of new wave washy sound that we really wanted to create. So I quite like that description. That it's like quite orchestral symphony. Yeah, I'm into that. Mm.
Now, you've got a couple of songs that deal with memory on the album, the title track, which I believe Mira wrote, right?
Yeah.
And then the song Flight from Angkor. Who wrote that one?
That was Mira as well.
So memory is in her mind these days, huh?
Yeah.
Because that also seems to be maybe memory, perception, and maybe depression as well.
I can't speak for Mira on that, but I wouldn't say it was depression. I think there's a kind of, not just in those songs, in across the album as a whole, I think there's definitely a new perspective present, or at least a clearer manifestation of it than before. There's certain themes that run through all the songs, as you say, dealing with memory, and as Helen said, an optimism that might be that could be misconstrued in a few instances as well. I find it interesting because you don't know an album until it's released. You step away the moment it's actually out. You step away and you see how it's received, and you listen to it in a different way as well. You don't necessarily understand the material and what binds the songs together until you've lived with it for a while. So stepping back, it was interesting for me because I saw threads within it that I hadn't necessarily recognized when we were recording. I always find this personally, as soon as a track is released, or an album is released, I hear depth in it that I didn't before somehow. I don't know how that works. I don't know. In the old days, I remember me and Helen outside listening on a portable radio, like the first time that we got played on Radio 1 or something, first time Playgirl got played on Radio 1. And we were outside this pub and it was like, they're playing it now, holding this radio up to our ears. In those days, I thought that records, when you released them, they'd be played on the radio and everyone would say, oh, everything sounds way better on the radio because it's more compressed and everything just sounds, you know, it fizzes. It's somehow better. But this happens now to me when I hear our own music. I'll listen to it during the mixing stage and everything else. You know, then you sit in it for a while until release, and then you release it and it's like, this sounds different. I don't know what it is. It's almost like superposition theory or something. It's because other people are actually observing it. It sounds different, and no one. I've never had a proper explanation for this. I guess I have to speak to some experts in metaphysics to explain this to me. But it's definitely a thing.
Well, you definitely hear music differently in different situations and ways. You know, you definitely do the superposition theory. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Well, you heard it here first. If it's true,
oh,
if it turns out to
Helen's
be true,
rolling her eyes.
I can be credited for it. I can be credited for this theory.
Helen?
No, I'm just laughing at Danny, that's all.
Look, you know, they might call me a crank now, but you watch. In 20 years.
Helen, what did you get your degree in?
Yeah, so it was music and popular music in Liverpool.
And what did Mira get her degree in?
Well, her first degree, I don't know, what was it, Danny? Science, chemistry or something? We don't even know.
I was just thinking, quite a difference.
Yes, yes, we're very different.
So how do those two things come together? The scientist, proto-geneticist, and the pop enthusiast.
I think you'll find we were placed together at an audition by Danny. Yes.
Not at the same time.
So, yes.
Uh-huh. But do you guys feel like you have a different sensibility towards things?
Yeah, I think, yes. I think Mira and I think differently. And I think that what we do in the band is very different as well. You know, we've all got our forties. So, yeah, I think we all play our part, and it works.
Mm-hmm.
It does work. So, I think, we gel quite well.
So on the album, you also have a couple of songs related to California. One called California. The other one, the opening track, City of Angels.
City of Angels, it's not specifically about LA. It's about a few places. Just to put it out there. But there's certain references in it that are. But I was thinking about a few different places. I was thinking of Paris and some other places that I'd lived. I guess that's a song about memory as well.
And California mm-hmm. isn't actually about California, so.
We just threw a spanner in the works now, didn't we?
It's not about California. What's it about then?
It's like a metaphor. Okay. So, well, it's
York.
A play, isn't it? It's a play. It's a play of two halves. So you've got New York and you've got California. So, yes, I don't think we need to describe it further. But
because funny that City of Angels, because I talked to Steve about that and he was like, "Oh, don't worry, everyone's going to think it's about LA anyway."
Yeah.
So you might as well just go with it.
Yeah, I mean,
it is called.
I like the fact that I've got a song. I've always wanted us to write a song called California, and then this just came to me and I was like, yes, finally. And I love that people in California will think it's about them, but obviously now they won't.
Well, what's it about?
I told you.
I saw some people complaining because we hadn't announced a live date in New York yet, because these dates that we're doing in May, that's just a little West Coast run
right
around the Just Like Heaven festival. And so people just assumed that we haven't done New York because New York never made us happy, as the lyric goes.
Oh, that's amazing.
No, we will.
I love New York. I love New York.
Yeah, they seemed really earnest about it as well. It's like, God, someone's got to tell them. It's not true.
Well, you did only say New York was fine.
Yeah, but I mean, when I say fine, I mean fine.
No, when a woman says it's fine, it means it's not that great.
No, I mean fine as in like beautiful, like sexy. That's what I mean. New York, you're sexy, but it's not enough.
Not well, York, so fine, rather than
yeah,
fine.
Like fine.
Mighty fine.
Yeah.
I know when I tell my wife that she looks fine, she doesn't take it well.
Well, you should just say sexy instead then.
I usually do, actually. Well, you know, you seem to have a lot of things about place, and I think The Dreamers is kind of about place, and you've got this line, dreaming our way out of this town. Yeah. What's that referencing?
It's funny because when I wrote this one, I didn't really think about it, but it's similar to Playgirl, isn't it, Danny?
Yeah. I only noticed that recently. I thought about it.
Yeah, I didn't really realize it at the time. Anyway, the lyrics are slightly similar. Like in Playgirl, it's like sleep your way out of your hometown. It's kind of similar. Anyway, so The Dreamers is a bit of a weird one. People might think that, you know, I wrote it in the middle of the pandemic or something, where if you were listening to the lyrics and you're like, the world's on fire and all that kind of stuff, and you're like, you're just trying to get away, and you're, let's say, dreaming of like you and your lover just going and like getting away kind of thing. But it wasn't. It was written a year or two before the pandemic. So I remember when it was all kicking off, and I think I messaged Danny and I was like, oh my God, this song, it's just like, it kind of resonates now with everything that's going on, like the world on fire and like, you know, everything's kind of blowing up kind of thing. So, yeah.
Quite a few of the songs.
Prophetic.
Were like this, that people interpreted them as, oh, they just assumed that we'd written them during that period. Yeah. And almost all of them were before, because we started recording the album literally as all hell was breaking loose. So we did 3 days in the studio in Glasgow before abandoning the session. We were in Mogwai's studio there and abandoned the session because we didn't know. I mean, no one had told us we had to stop, but it was, can we really continue with this? No one knew what was going to happen. So as we all remember, we actually made a conscious decision to try and insulate the material of the album from the pandemic, because we thought no one's going to want to think about this once it's over. I think that the little things that people were doing, art influenced by what was happening, will be an interesting record in the future. But I don't imagine anyone wants to see or listen to this or hear about it now. So we kept the album as far away from that as we could. But just because of the timing of it, people assumed that it would have been influenced by it. It was influenced by it in how difficult the record was to make, flying backwards and forwards and, you know, trying to get together where and when we could. But I think that the effect it had on the record, at least for me, is that it was like a paralysis, a few months of paralysis, because after we stopped recording and everyone went into lockdown, I imagined, oh, I'm going to go home and go into the studio and I'm just going to use this time productively. I'm just going to work on music. It didn't happen because I couldn't imagine the world that the record was going to be released into anymore, because we were being told so many conflicting things. It was going to be a zombie apocalypse at one end of the spectrum, and the other end of the spectrum was the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, where capitalism was going to be destroyed and all these positive things were going to happen. Remember this?
I knew that wasn't going to happen. I was
skeptical, but I was so bewildered by this, so disorientated, that was the main effect it had. I spent a good 3 months just, you know, drinking bottles of beer and staring at the sky. I didn't do anything useful. In terms of the writing, I don't think it left any mark on that at all.
Do you feel that, Helen?
Yeah, absolutely. As we said, a lot of it done before. Very little of the album was done during. So as well, like after all that time, like in solitude or wherever you were, indoors, like, for me, I just wanted to like create some joy. Like for me, that's all I wanted to think of. I was like, right, I want people to dance. Like I want like happiness. I want hope. I don't want this, like this inward kind of like sadness. So I kind of think that's what we projected into the album. And I do think that we were kind of successful with that. So.
Well, I do have a quote from you saying that I couldn't stand a lot of the music that was coming out during the pandemic and post-pandemic.
I did say that. Yes, I did. And I still stand by it. Yeah, I got all the lyrics. Oh, my God. It was like, get a grip, people. Like, I don't want to hear this. I really don't want to hear it. That sounds mean, but no.
Because we're all in the same boat.
Exactly.
We're all in the same boat. So, you know, and as I say, in the future, it might be interesting to look at this, but
yeah,
it's the same thing. It's like no one could complain. I think this was part of the difficulty of that period, an inability to complain, because everyone had it varying degrees of difficulty. There was always many people worse than whatever situation you were in yourself, and it was impossible to complain. And I think that was why it became difficult for people to withstand mentally, because they didn't have any means of venting their, you know, their fears and their experiences. We just had to knuckle down. But I think it was good that in a way that the solidarity aspect of it, I did enjoy the fact that there was people making Facebook lives and stuff like that and making streams. It's like trying to raise morale. It was like this kind of campfire songs. That was sweet for a while, because I feel like everyone really needed it. But 6 months in, it was like, no.
I think there's ways of connecting with people without being so literal. And for me, everything was too literal. So I want music to take me out of my own head, but still there be a connection somehow. And yeah, a lot of the stuff that was coming out was just too much. It was like they lost perspective. And why does it need to be so obvious? It doesn't need to be obvious. You can connect without that.
Mm. Well, let me ask you, when you're writing your lyrics, Helen, are you thinking more musically than lyrically sometimes?
I tend to generally write the music first, normally, and then I'll do the lyrics after, generally. But, so I guess you could say the music's... No, it isn't more important because I'm one of these listeners that actually does, like, hang on to lyrics. A lot of people listen to music and it isn't... They can listen to a song and then you'll get them to, like, sing it back and they just won't know the lyrics. It doesn't go in. But for me, I am the opposite. And so lyrics are really important to me. It's important when I write them that they make sense and, yeah, are vague. That's kind of what I prefer.
We've always been impressionistic. The lyrics have always been impressionistic with us. I think it's rarely ever been storytelling, or it's always been impressionistic. So what you say is like thinking about it musically. I would say yes, in a sense, because you're adding these impressionistic motifs that are actually inspired by the music that you're listening to. And this is how, you know, the creative process, how the ideas emerge. And I think that moment actually is incredibly interesting. The moment between having a finished song and having an instrumental piece with a melody, how those ideas actually come about and coalesce, I think is super interesting. I don't know how it works, but I saw the Let It Be documentary actually. And there was one point when McCartney starts playing a track from scratch on his bass, and it's while the whole thing is falling apart. You know, George is probably gone. I don't know. I can't remember what exact point. It was either, I think it might have been Get Back, actually, itself. Oh, I'm talking about Get Back, not Let It Be, of course. Let It Be is the other side of that story. But you actually see the moment there. You see the moment of genesis of the song directly from when you've basically got just phonetics, just, you know, syllables emerging, forming words and forming sentences and forming a story. And you actually see this in real time. I don't think anyone's actually seen that before, that process, let alone from such a well-known artist. And I found that part, like, the most fascinating of the whole doc, because it's such a raw moment. Your mind is bare for a second. So that lends itself, it lends itself to the impressionistic side more so.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Jojo had about five names before he was Jojo.
yeah, that's right.
Helen, I want to get back to something you said. I wonder if I heard this right. You said you want to make have lyrics that make sense and are vague. That seems a little contradictory.
It does, but doesn't it make sense? I think to get a point across, or like Danny says, these impressionistic like images or creating a sense, you don't have to spell it out for people. People can work that out for themselves. They can spell that out in their own head. We don't need to do it for them. So if I just present an image or parts of an image, then they'll join the dots and it'll become their own image or their own thoughts or feelings, and that's what you want, isn't it? I want it to be relative to them, not necessarily to me.
I mean, that's how I enjoy music like this. I mean, I don't understand any other way of doing it. You have your interpretation, and that has its own power. So even though the artist has their own conception of what a song is and what it's about and what it means to them, it's wonderful if the audience have their own. It seems far more valuable than if it was spelled out. And obviously there's incredible singer-songwriters in history and it is completely spelled out, but it's a different thing, you know, like having a, you know, a 5-minute preamble talking about what a song's about, you know, that lasts 2 minutes. maybe we'll do that someday.
Well, getting back to one of the songs, one of the ones I really love and that we're playing a lot on the show is We Never Went Away, which is kind of a heartbreaking song.
Yeah.
Is that you, Helen, or is that Mira?
That's Danny.
That's one of mine, actually.
You're on to yours.
It's like a preemptive conversation with grief. It's like, I got a few messages actually when the album first came out, and people were saying, oh my God, Danny, I'm listening to We Never Went Away and I'm crying. And I was like, no, please, please don't cry. You're not supposed to cry. But when I was doing it, I started actually listening to, again, going back to Beatles again, because they're inescapable. But All Things Must Pass. So isn't it a pity? I wouldn't say that they were an influence, a direct influence on it. But when I was listening, once we had the album mixed, and I started listening to All Things Must Pass. I can't remember what made me start putting it on again. And it started to remind me of that a little bit. But yeah, it's quietly one of my favorites that I've done.
Yeah, it's a beautiful tune. Yeah, it did sound like it was a bit about death.
Yeah, it's grief, yeah. And not necessarily death, but yeah.
Were you aware of The Normal?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because I went back, I hadn't listened to Light and Magic for a little while, and I went back to that. That sounded like it was right out of The Normal.
So
I mean, it was so stripped back and primitive, and even the vocal styling was kind of Normal-esque.
The True Mathematics, a lot of people thought that sounded like Warm Leatherette at the time. It's funny, I think it was actually, it was more coincidental than it might have seemed. Because I remember at that time we were doing tracks and then someone would send me something going, oh, have you heard this? And it would sound like something we'd done, but we hadn't necessarily heard. So I'm not even sure I heard Warm Leatherette before we did True Mathematics, but definitely sounds similar ballpark to it. There's a certain, a synergy.
So you started out with these analog keyboards, but have you moved really pretty much into computer, or is it still, you're sticking with the analog keyboards?
It's both. It's
yeah.
Doing writing, it's incredible to have all these sounds and options at your disposal. And you can work and write anywhere. But once we're into the recording, the nuts and bolts of things, that's when we start adding layers and replacing things. And just if we can make it sound better, we will. So we've never gone completely digital or anything. It's great to have them. I mean, the option just to be able to. I mean, like we were talking about during the pandemic, I was stranded at one point. I came back to record some vocals with Helen in Scotland, and I couldn't fly home. So I ended up stranded for about a month, I think, in the end. And all I had was my laptop and a couple of speakers. And I wrote a load of new tracks then, actually. It was probably the most productive time of the whole period. So if I hadn't had that at my disposal, it would have been come away with an output. But yeah, it's we've never gone completely digital. I wonder whether people can hear the difference, because sometimes it feels like when you insist that you need things to be outside the box, not just instruments, compression, everything else, and a lot of effort's put into that and time and money. And then sometimes I wonder, is anyone hearing this? Is anyone actually hearing the difference? I don't know.
Helen, can you hear the difference?
Well, yeah.
I'll tell you, I listen to a ton of electronic music. I mean, a lot. It's kind of what I'm expert in. And I can't tell the difference. Except sometimes in the outcome.
Uh-huh.
For instance, have you gotten into the whole modular analog thing at all?
Well,
no.
I know friends who've got into it.
It's beyond me.
But I feel like it's like I compare it to, it's almost like, like an amateur car mechanic. It's all about the gear and the equipment and setting things up and fixing things and connecting them together. And sometimes I wonder how much music is actually being made with this equipment. I mean, it looks great and it's incredible fun to play with. But I think if I went down the modular route, I don't think I would do anything. I don't think you wouldn't hear music out of me for 10 years because I'd just be messing with it. So I've stayed away from that, but I enjoy it when I go in other people's studio and they've got a wall full of it.
Well, that people using those systems, I think it almost always has a particular sound in a way. And they, I don't think you'd be writing Ladytron songs on that kind of equipment.
I think you'd be ruled by the equipment. Yeah, you'd be shaped by it. Mm-hmm. So there's good records made with it, of course. But.
So you're touring just the West Coast? You're not going to come east at all?
We will. It's just the way we tour now is we do these small runs. It's just a lot more humane. You know, we've gone through the phases of being on the road for months on end, going home for a week and going out again when we were in our 20s. And we wouldn't do that now. None of us would want to do that now. We have to be a bit more efficient with everything. We try our best. We're not being lazy or anything. It's more just self-preservation.
Okay, I got a couple of just wrap-it-up questions. Just getting back to Flight from Encore, do you know why Encore is a reference in that song? It's not actually in the song, it's just in the title.
I assumed, without having talked to Mira about it, it described the evacuation of that city or the depopulation of that city in relation to the theme of the song. That's how I took it, but I don't know what Mira had in mind. That's what it sounds like to me.
Okay. Okay. So those Christine Aguilera tracks that you did, have you ever recorded them yourselves? Because those are pure Ladytron tracks.
They were tracks that were Ladytron tracks that we put in.
Yeah.
If she hadn't done them, they would have been on the subsequent album or albums.
Right.
So very much cut from the same cloth as Gravity the Seducer and Velocifero.
But you've never recorded them as Ladytron tracks, right?
Those Christina ones? No, no.
Yeah.
No. Some people have asked us to, but no. Well, I mean, we co-wrote them. So, I mean, on Birds of Prey, we wrote the chorus and part of the verse and obviously the music. On Little Dreamer, that was all her, that was her melody and lyric. Whereas in Birds of Prey is more like a Ladytron track because of the vocal, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I wasn't aware of that album at all when it came out because she's definitely not in my field of vision, if you will. Okay, so you're kind of a synth pop group. I've interviewed a lot of synth pop groups. They all mention one band as an influence.
Ladytron.
I've never seen you mention it. So what band... Do you know who I'm talking about?
Depeche Mode?
They get mentioned a lot, but Depeche Mode mentions this group.
Kraftwerk?
Very good.
Okay.
Got a cigar.
I think we don't mention them because it just seems obvious. They're just part of the sound. Anyone making electronic music is influenced by Kraftwerk in the same way as anyone in a guitar band is influenced by the Beatles in some kind of, you know, five times removed way. So there's no reason to mention them. Okay, a slight misconception about us, because our first single had a sort of, if you strip away the song and the chords and everything else and the rhythm, it doesn't actually sound like Kraftwerk, but it had like a few little riffs that were kind of thrown in playfully, kind of in the spirit of the time. We're talking about 1998. Where people were sampling everything and it was just, everything was up for grabs and you could just, there would be little references here and there. So it was more in that spirit. But as time went on, when we were still playing that song live, we'd stripped all those parts away. And in a way, I wish that we'd recorded it a bit later for that reason. So we reinterpreted it as like, oh, this band sound like Kraftwerk, when we didn't really. And then we played with that a little bit with the way we did like a photo shoot and we wore like these red matching red tops and things like that. And we were playing with it. But what made me laugh is that after going through all this, no, I don't think that anyone's ever noticed this, but the second album, we had these uniforms made. They were like the second version of our uniforms we used to wear at the beginning. They were designed and tailored and they had these little epaulettes and they were really nice. And so what made me laugh is that when Kraftwerk came back as actual showroom dummies, when they just had like, you know, dummies on stage, they were wearing these jackets. I was like, but they look like our jackets. They never wore them in the 70s. This is completely perverse now. And I don't, and it was so kind of weird. And I was like, I don't think I can say this in public because people will think I'm a what are you saying? Kraftwerk ripped you off.
It's come full circle.
So this is the first time I've ever actually mentioned this.
No, Helen, I just said it's come something? Full circle. You're being controversial, Danny.
Full circle, yeah.
I know, it's not. I mean, you know, it's fine. There's no chronology anymore. Year zero.
Well, speaking of that, that's interesting. Do you know what your number one song is on Spotify?
17.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, by more than double.
That only happened in the last 2 years. Yeah. It was a distant second behind Destroy Everything You Touch until 2 years ago when this insane thing happened on TikTok, a platform that we didn't and still don't understand or have any access to. Yeah, that was quite strange. And yeah, it's sort of still going on, to be honest. A lot of new audience that way. The audience at our recent shows, our first shows back in the UK now, you saw a bit of that, some new people who their perspective on the band was very different to the people who'd been coming to our gigs, you know, when we were last out there. Very interesting. Right. But again,
what was the TikTok thing?
Huh? The TikTok thing.
What was
thing?
The TikTok
was,
thing?
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought you knew about it.
It was like kids lip syncing to 17 and dancing and just filming themselves. So,
talking about their own interpretations and stuff like that, and their own experiences.
It's like a whole new audience for 17. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You'll have to see if I can find it online somewhere besides TikTok because I don't have
don't
I don't
think
have
you
it.
Will.
It happened very quickly. I mean, within a few weeks, suddenly 17 was popping up in top tens and things like that. You'd get sent an alert, and it's like, oh, you're in the top 10. Mm. And it was strange, actually. I remember seeing like that album cover of Light and Magic that's 20 years old and seeing it next to these contemporary records in these top tens was really strange. It was quite eerie. I don't think, you know, because it's not something we imagined happening. Obviously, that the technology didn't exist, the platforms didn't exist. So very curious, all of it.
So on the song The Night, it opens up with you singing Crazy. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear that until I saw the lyrics.
That would be all
like
the reverb
so
we're using.
Buried. Yeah, on that particular phrase, we were just saying crazy. Yeah, until I looked at the lyrics, I didn't even know that was there.
It's really pop, I think. And the lyrics are kind of pop, so.
Pop, kind of pop?
Yeah, I think so.
I was wondering if there was a Prince reference in there.
Obviously, yes. Yes. I mean, that's it. It's like, let's dance, let's go crazy. Let's go crazy.
I think
crazy,
that's the most Madonna. That's the most Madonna you ever got, I think, that one.
Yeah, it's as close as I'm going to get.
Because I said like a few years ago, I was like sitting in a bar down here and the waitress was asking me what I did, and I said I was in a band, I did music, whatever, and she was like, oh, what kind of music? And I started explaining it just in technical terms, just breaking it down. And when I'd finished, she said, what, like Madonna? and I said, actually, yeah, why don't we just say that from now on? Let's not try and describe what we are. Let's just say we sound like Madonna. Let's just go for it.
Helen, it was a true pleasure meeting you and talking to you. Thank you so much.
Lovely to chat with you and you, Danny. And I have to go now, so I'll just say bye. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, man, it was a great talking to you too, Danny.
Yeah,
it was a
too.
Real pleasure.
Thanks a lot. That was fun. Man. Okay, cheers, man. Cheers, John. Bye-bye.
Take care. I will have a link to Lady Tron's Times Arrow in the posting for this podcast. That posting will also include a playlist of their feature. It's at echoes.org. Next week in the Echoes podcast, I've got Liz Addison. She talks about her ambient album, songs from Lamara, and a career that has taken her from the avant-garde to New Age and beyond. And remember, you can make a donation to Echoes and the Echoes podcast at echoes.org. Just hit the support tab at Echoes, echoes.org. I'm John DiLiberto. This has been the Echoes podcast from PRX. See you next week, tonight on the radio somewhere in the country, or at Echoes Online right now or whenever you want. You can find out more about that at echoes.org.